Shrink Wrap Radio number 528, The Hidden Logic Behind Our Motivations, with Dr. Dan Ariely.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my return guest is social psychologist and TED presenter and author, Dr. Dan Ariely, and we'll be discussing his 2016 book, Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. For more information about Dr. Dan Ariely, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Today's episode is sponsored by SwellBee.com, a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to manage and market their practice. Free and easy to use. Sign up today at SwellBee.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dan Ariely, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back on the show. Today, we're going to be discussing your latest book, Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. I've got a beautiful copy right here. It's a thin volume, but packs so much information in such a thin volume. You've written a number of books now about our often paradoxical and unexpected irrationality in making certain kinds of decisions. And this latest book is about motivation. So it only makes sense that I should ask you, what's your motivation behind this book? And can we trust that you understand your motivation?
Yeah. So, first of all, I haven't thought about this, but yes, almost for sure you shouldn't trust my motivation or my full insight about motivation. But if I think about the motivation for this book, I think is first of all, you know, motivating people is something very basic about what we do. We motivate employees, we motivate our kids, our significant other, the people that work with us. And we see more and more that people have this very, very simplistic view of human motivation. Hmm. Earlier this year, I wrote a short piece for the Mayo Clinic Journal. And in that piece, I looked at physicians and their happiness. And it turns out that about 400 physicians commit suicide every year.
Wow.
It's a very, very high number.
Yeah.
And their level of happiness has decreased over the years more than any other profession that I could see.
Mm.
And if you think about what's happening with physicians, it's that we take people who are committed to helping patients, and you basically make them into robots that do paperwork.
Yeah.
But you don't give them much room for judgment. You don't give them much room for decisions. You regulate everything they do, and you force them to spend a lot of their hours doing paperwork. And as a consequence, you get tremendously demotivated people. And, you know, one of the things that we do is we force more and more regulation all the time. So the first thing that got me interested in this is kind of this just ubiquity of motivation. The second thing is, you know, I hate human waste. And I think with motivation, I see a dramatic amount of human waste. I see all the cases where we're not just not helping motivation, we're actively killing it. And
yeah.
Policymakers, employers, and so on. So how do we figure this out? You know, at least let's not decrease motivation. I mean, it would be nice to increase motivation, but at least let's not kill it. And in too many cases, I see us actually decreasing motivation. It's just a shame. So that's one kind of one aspect that is just about motivation. But the other aspect is, you know, we have this very basic view of the pleasure principle. What do? We search for pleasure. What's a dream? To sit on the beach drinking mojitos, right? That's kind of
yeah.
our dream. And if we could only reach that, everything would be fine. And we work just because we don't have enough money for mojitos. So, you know, we have to work harder. But we get it wrong. We are motivated by all kinds of things. Just think about your podcast. You told me earlier, what number of podcasts is this?
I think this is number 527.
Okay. And you've been going for how many years?
11 years.
Okay. And you're doing it because you are enjoying it. You think you're contributing. Yeah. You get joy from the fact that other people are using it as a resource.
Exactly.
And nothing about writing this as people hate effort and they like sitting on drinking mojito, will explain your behavior.
No.
Right? So it's not just about the labor market. It's really about what are the things that we care about and how do we understand what we care about and how do we understand separately the things that we think we care about but we actually don't. So that's really kind of the attempt of the book. And the final thing I would say about the book is I start the book with a very personal story about my own life
and
challenges with motivation. And I end the book with something about death and motivation around death, which is very hard to study. But I try to look a little bit at history and so on and kind of speculate about what does death and what we want happening to us after we die tell us about what really drives us.
Yeah. Well, you know, your book seems very much oriented towards the work situation, even though motivation is, you know, applies so widely. But it seems like mostly it's oriented towards employers and how they can do motivation better than they do. And maybe we should just back up.
And part of course, is that this is where the experiments are coming from.
Uh-huh. Right? So, and you've done a lot of experiments, and I hope you'll throw some in. I'm not asking you any questions about specific experiments, but where they're relevant, let's put some in there. And I just want to let people know you're both a social psychologist and a leading figure in the relatively new field of behavioral economics, for which Daniel Kahneman, another psychologist, and an Israeli, I think, received a 2002 Nobel Prize for his findings that challenged human reality, rationality, and economic behavior. Is he considered the founder of behavioral economics or not?
You know, it's kind of interesting to think about economics in a big time frame, in a longer time frame, because economics wasn't always kind of neoclassical economics with the assumption of economics. So if you think about Adam Smith, that people think about the father of, you know, neoclassical economics, he wrote this very famous book, The Wealth of Nations, where, you know, the term, the thought about the invisible hand is coming from. He also wrote a wonderful book called The Moral Sentiment.
Okay.
And The Moral Sentiment is a very psychological book. So economics was not always so much about assumptions about rationality. There's lots of school of economics that are not, and historically it was more like that. But what Danny and Amos did in their early work is to bring new life into this field and to experiment with it in a very clever way. So they kind of took gambles as the fruit fly for behavioral economics. And because gambles for economists represented so much about how people should be thinking about the world, and they show lots of ways in which we don't make choices in line with what rationality would predict. So they very much kind of gave a whole new wind and direction and energy to this field. So from that perspective, I think they are the founder of the particular stream that I'm part of.
Yeah, were you a student of Kahneman?
So I was not a student. Danny came to the University of Tel Aviv when I was an undergrad.
Okay.
And we met, we talked, and then he was trying to convince me to come to grad school with him. I did not do it at that time. He offered me again later on. I didn't do it a second time. But we've had a very we've had a good relationship in exchange over the years. So.
Yeah. Well, good. And, you know, the title, the subtitle of your book is The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. And, of course, it's hard not to think about Freud, who said that so much of what we do is unconscious, and yet this theory comes from a somewhat different direction than Freud was thinking of, right?
Yeah, very much. And, you know, the notion of the Freudian unconsciousness is that there are forces that drive us, are the part of our personality, but that they're hidden, right? It's kind of the id and a superego, and there's a kind of combat within the person that we're not always allowed to we not always understand, and that they reflect some conflict. Behavioral economics in general, you know, there's lots of similarities, of course, with that metaphor, right? There's lots of similarities of how emotion and cognition work, for example. And you can think of those as reflections of the id and the superego. But a lot of behavioral economics is about the fact that we actually don't think so deeply about what we end up doing.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, the environment matters a lot, right? So in Freudian terms, everything was internal, but there was no room for how the environment shapes what we're doing. Whereas one of the things about behavioral economics is that we find that if we change the environment, people behave very differently.
Right.
So that was just not something that was part of his theory. He didn't speculate about that, right? It wasn't just a part of what was interesting. And for behavioral economists, especially when we think about interventions, we often think about what interventions can we make in the world to get people to behave differently. But so we have the outside model and the inside model, but then on the inside of the model, there are some parallels to the Freudian theory.
Fascinating. I found myself wondering if there was any evolutionary value to the limitations in our cognition, or if it's a bug in our cognitive software, a design flaw.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that in general, we think that it has some evolutionary reason, right? For most things, right? So the most maybe clear example is to think about the roles of emotion, right? Why do we have emotion? The notion is that if you are in the jungle and you see a tiger, you shouldn't start wondering what you should do. You should not take the time and say, should I run? Should I stay? Let me open an Excel spreadsheet, calculate the odds, the probability, and so on. No, you should just run, right? And there's an asymmetry of mistakes, right? If you run and nothing, it wasn't really a tiger, not such a big problem. If you did not run and it's really a tiger, that's a really big problem.
Yes, yeah.
Or even if you think about loss aversion, right? Why are we more sensitive to losses than to gains? The idea is that if we eat poison and something is bad, it can kill us. If we get something positive, we live a few more hours, but we don't get infinite gains, but we can get infinite losses. So there are lots of things that you can speculate about the evolutionary basis. Now, of course, these days we don't live in the same evolutionary environment, right? So you could say something like, you know what? Experiencing anger or the sense of revenge might be a sensible thing to do in a society that had no police force and no judicial system. In a system that has those things, maybe not such a good idea.
So maybe over time we develop some kinds of cognitive rules of thumb, if you will, that to make decision-making fast when it needed to be very fast, as in the tiger example.
That's right. And that's, now there's another thing, is that even though we can tell stories about the evolutionary case, as a scientist, it's not always satisfying. And I'll tell you why. So when Darwin looked at the finches, if I remember correctly, he had 16 different types of finches. And he could look at the ratio of the beak, base, and size, and so on, and he could speculate about them. But he had multiple versions of them. When we think about human beings, we kind of have one type, right? We don't have enough types of people that vary to basically look at differences within people on an evolutionary scale. There are a lot of individual differences, but they're not evolutionary differences. So, you know, you look at, for example, if you look across animals, I think there's some correlation between the size of the testicle of the male and how long is the period that the parents take care of the offspring. You could do that across species. When we take just humans, there's lots of things that we can't vary. So, okay. so we can tell these stories that make sense, but it's a little hard to know how do we ever disqualify them. Now, that's not true for all of evolutionary psychology. There's all kinds of things that in evolutionary psychology are incredibly that we can experiment with. But there's also a range of things that are probably right. They sound reasonable. You know, the odds are in favor, but we don't have a way to prove them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, coming back to the concrete aspects of your book, you kind of back into the topic by listing some of the ways that managers and others destroy motivation. You kind of alluded to that in the beginning. So what are the don'ts when we're trying to motivate people?
Yeah, so sadly, there's lots of them. So, you know, we mentioned physicians and how we kill their motivation. Teachers are the same thing, right, in the same category. So you know, we take teachers who are dedicated to teaching and go to learn how to become teachers. And then at some point we said, oh, you know, we have this thing called the No Child Left Behind policy. And you, teacher, have to teach to this test. And the only thing we care about is this test. And if you do very well on this test, if your kids will do very well on this test, we'll give you $400. And what is the consequence of that thing is that we take autonomy away from teachers. They have no control over what to teach. They feel that they're just teaching for the test and not really creating educational value. And they become less motivated for doing it. So these are just kind of policy examples. As individual examples, there's a company not too far from where I am that I visited not too long ago that decided to have not only cubicles, but to have cubicles that are temporary. So think about cubicles in general. Yeah. Cubicles just scream you're replaceable.
Right. Impersonality. Right?
There's no personality. Every cubicle is just like the same. And some of them, you even have like a Velcro that you put your name on it, right? Somebody could just come and take it and replace it with something else. Or, you know, it slides in somehow. It screams of you're just here temporarily. And at any moment, we can ask you to leave. So this one company went a step even further. And they said, nobody has their own cubicle. Come every morning and you can pick a cubicle that you want.
And they hang any pictures in there or anything like that.
Of course. I mean, you can bring some pictures in your suitcase, in your briefcase and put them up, but, you know, nobody's going to do it.
Yeah.
But by doing so, and the logic was try and come early and get the good cubicles.
Okay.
But by doing so, they basically gave people an extra signal that nothing that they do is long-term. So imagine the following scenario. Imagine that you wake up next to your significant other every morning, and every morning you decide if to continue being married for one more day. Like marriage contracts are one day at a time. So you wake up in the morning, you look at your significant other lovingly into their eyes, and you say, what do you say, darling? Shall we do this for another day or not? Now this idea of, and you can have a contract with your significant other, it could be about the house, whatever it is, how much would you invest in your relationship? How much would you invest in your apartment? You know, would you paint the walls? I mean, all kinds of things. And what we know is that when people think they have a long-term relationship, that's where investment comes in. And companies, not on purpose, but unwittingly, are basically communicating in all kinds of ways to people that this is a very temporary relationship. You're not here for the long term, right? Yeah, just so you know, you can be replaced in every moment. From this perspective, by the way, it's interesting to think about tenure, right? Yeah. So of course, we have tenure at the university, and tenure is kind of a promise to say you have a job for life unless you do something illegal, right? And the vast majority of people, even though they could at that moment stop working, they don't. We actually change what we do. We sometimes work harder, and we care more about the goals of the school. I mean, all kinds of things happen when you create this level of saying, hey, we're here for the long term together, right? And all of a sudden, the school is a part of you in an important way.
Right. So you said that teaching at Duke, where you are a professor, was a win-win for you. And I was a professor until I retired, and it was definitely a win-win for me. And as you observed for yourself, it was hard to imagine yourself doing something different. And I would say the same thing for me. So why is the university so motivating?
Yeah, so I think this it's about reciprocity and about long term. So again, if you work somewhere and you say, you know, I have they could always give me a 2-week notice. I just met with lunch from somebody from a high tech company, a big tech company, and he said that every year they fire a lot of people. It's not Microsoft, but I think Microsoft too every year had a ritual of firing 10% or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, so what you tell people, you say perform, and so on, and it's about, you know, making it last for another year so we don't fire you. And I think that the idea of tenure at the university is kind of like marriage. It's kind of like saying, you know, don't worry about the ebbs and flows in the short term because we have a long term together here. So, you know, imagine that your employer came to you and say, you know what, for the next year, we really want you to work extra hard. It's just really important for us, you know, this next year, please just come on the weekends, every day on the weekend, just come for the next year. If you think they could fire you at any moment, you would say no.
Right.
But if you basically said, you know what, we have 30 years together, I'll be a better citizen this year, and then we'll see what happens next year. So you know, across the world and across all kinds of jobs, but as we move in more and more towards the knowledge economy, we rely more and more on people's goodwill. Right. So in my case, you know, I came last night from South America. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to do a lecture for the Duke alumni in Philadelphia. Right. This is completely at my discretion. Right. I could do it. I couldn't do it. Nobody tells me that this is something to do, but this is partly of my goodwill. Right. I know that we have alumni group in all kinds of places. I know that they from time to time get benefit from getting together. And I decide to spend some time doing this thing for the alumni.
So you're willing to get on planes and travel around the world and all the discomforts that go along with that.
But that's goodwill, and this is it's easily measurable because I'm flying to a different city, but there's lots of things that we do at work out of goodwill. You know, if all of us wanted to work the least amount possible, we would work much less. But we have a portion of goodwill, and goodwill is very hard to buy. It doesn't come by giving you a salary or a raise. Goodwills come from long-term connection with the company or the organization, care about the mission, feeling autonomy, feeling that you're making progress, reciprocity, a social relationship, all kinds of things like that. And I think that as we move more and more toward a legally binding world, we're sometimes losing goodwill, right? We're trying to contract everything and have rules for everything, and we're losing that. So I love the metaphor of relationship, romantic relationship, as a metaphor for how we should think about any kind of long-term relationship, not just romantic relationship.
You know, we tend to think that money is the thing that motivates people. A lot of companies have that feeling, but it seems like the world is changing in some regards in that way. And you've done research that kind of compares in laboratory sorts of situations, money versus praise and recognition versus controls. Maybe you want to cite a piece of that kind of research.
Sure. So we've done all kinds of things in the lab, but in this book I also describe one field experiment that we did with Intel, the chip manufacturer.
Yeah.
And in this experiment, Intel had the following procedure. So people would come for 4 days to work, and then they had 4 days off. 4 days on, 4 days off. And on the first day that people showed up to this work cycle, Intel said, you know, you just came back from 4 days vacation. We want you to kind of get into work in all in. So we will give you a target and a bonus. And if you reach this target, we'll give you $30. And if you don't reach, you'll get nothing. And then no bonus or target on the second day, third day, or fourth day, 4 days off, back to the first day with the target. So when we heard about this, we said, what about having a control condition? Let's also have a condition in which people get nothing and we don't give them a goal and target and a bonus. And they said, okay. And then what about, then we said, what about a social reward? What about on giving people a target and say, if you reach this target, we'll send you pizza at home on that night. Mm-hmm. And we said, this way you'll be a hero in the eyes of your family as well, not just for you. But this was very difficult for the HR department at Intel. So we agreed eventually on a voucher for pizza. It's not the same. But
not the same, no.
And then we had the fourth condition of a compliment. So here's what happened. People came on that first day of the shift. Let's call it a Monday. A quarter of the people were told nothing. A quarter of the people were told, if you perform at this level, you'll get $30. A quarter were told, if you perform at this level, you'll get a voucher for pizza. A quarter were told, if you perform at this level, you'll get a text message from the boss saying, work well done. So that's what happened. And another question is, what happened? So on that first day of the shift, the control condition was lower and all three conditions were better. Money was slightly worse. The other two were slightly better, but all three conditions were. However, we also had the next day. Now remember, on the second day, there was no bonus. But you can ask the question of whether there's any residue from the bonus of the day previous on performance. And there was. What happened? The money went up. And on the next day, it basically shot down. It went down by 12% below the control condition. It was as if people said, yesterday you paid me, I was interested. Today you're not paying me, I'm not working again. So it went up on the first day, went down on the second day, went slightly up and caught back on the fourth condition. And in total, by giving people a financial bonus, Intel lost the money of the bonus plus 5% of productivity. What happened in the complement condition? Performance went up slightly more than money and slowly went down over the week. And in the pizza condition, it went up like the complement, went down kind of almost halfway between the money and the complement. And I suspect that if the voucher for pizza was more transactional, it would have looked more like the money. And if it was more social, it would have looked more like the complement. But here's an example of money is not just an additive incentive. It actually changes people's relationship to their labor. And people basically said what we see happening with the No Child Left Behind policy, where people say, you know what, yesterday you paid me, I was interested, today you're not paying me. This is really, that's all I'm worth to you? I thought I'm here because we have a joint mission and we care about this and so on. All that you're trying to do is to motivate me to work in the short term for $30? I don't care about the job in general.
Yeah, it kind of moves it away from the long-term orientation that goodwill implies to a very contingent, temporary thing that's constantly being reevaluated. Okay, you paid me yesterday. What are you going to do for me today?
That's right, exactly. And I think that we have this notion of, you know, people on the production line, which is also true for physicians, right, and teachers. We just say, oh,
more and more.
And a production line is not about long-term thinking and motivation and so on.
Yeah, yeah. I've worked on a production line. So I, as a young man, so I know that to be the case. And the medical situation, it feels more and more factory-like. I mean, I didn't know about the paperwork aspect so much, but when I in my health plan and go to see the doctor, they got them stacked up. Yeah. Stacked up, and I don't think there's much time for physicians to really give the individual cases much deep thought.
No, you know, recently a guy who's a physician here at Duke came to dinner at my house. It was the weekend, and it was 9:30, and he said he has to go home to bed. I said, "It's the weekend. What's going on? Why are you hurry?" And he said he said his day, he needs to be on a regular day. He needs to be in the office before 7. He sees his first patient at 7. He sees patients every 15 minutes, every 15 wow. minutes, another patient until 3 o'clock. Then he runs to the operating room, and he's there until 7. And he said that if he doesn't sleep well, he can't be at his best. He said he even schedule bathroom breaks and when he can go to get coffee. Now, and he told me, he said, "You don't understand how good your life is. You meet with people, like you think you're busy. You're meeting people for an hour. If you need to take a coffee break, you ask the people, 'Hey, would you walk with me to get coffee?'" A physician can't do anything like that. And he said that even though it's the weekend, if he doesn't fall asleep by 10, he is stressed. And he says sometimes when he sees he doesn't fall asleep, he takes sleeping pills because he's so worried about not having a good night's sleep and not being on top of his game for the patients.
I don't want to be operated on by somebody who's under that kind of pressure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes. And you know what? You also don't want to know what kind of pressure they're under.
Yeah.
It's really terrible.
Yeah.
It's really
terrible. Yeah. Well, there's some other elements that you touch on in the book about what does motivate people. And one is instead of the anonymity implied by the cubicle situation, that when people have a sense that they're creating something, that they're involved in creating something significant, that that's important. A pride of creativity, I guess.
Creation, ownership, and so on. Yes, and the nicest example for this, I think, is the open source movement. Right? When you think about it, for quite a few years ago, we started with this open source movement, and it's really quite an amazing thing, right? It's amazing that the only real big competitor to Microsoft in terms of an operating system, right, outside of Apple, is Linux, which is a system that is created by people who are volunteered.
Yeah.
Volunteers.
Yeah.
Right? How come we have Linux and, you know, many of the servers that we're all using are on Linux?
Yeah.
And how can it be that we have such a powerful system that is all by open source? And part of the advances in open source was actually a legal advance. And what they did was to create rules where if you write a piece of code, your name would always be associated with this piece of code, and nobody else could use it without your terms of service, which means it's free and so on. And that created tremendous investment, because imagine how much you would contribute to a piece of code if your name was not on it.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody else could take it and all of a sudden make a business.
Yeah.
Out of it. But that basically make it yours.
Mm-hmm.
And every time people use it, you get the feeling that you've contributed.
Yeah. Good example. What about Wikipedia? Would Wikipedia be another example?
Another example. People are incredibly proud of contribution to Wikipedia.
And here you mentioned Microsoft, you know, this behemoth. And here you've got Encyclopedia Britannica. I think Wikipedia has probably almost put them out of business.
Oh yeah, not almost. They have.
They have. Okay.
Yeah, I mean it's you can't compare the size of the two.
Wow.
So this idea of having our name connected to things, and you know, often people really are worried about credit, who is taking the credit, and bosses are taking the credit from their employees and so on. But credit and public credit with people's name connected to it creates such a value for people. It's a tremendous thing. You know, I remember the first time I published a book. So before I published the book, I had academic papers in an academic journal. But you get the journal, and you know your name is on it, but lots of people's names.
Yeah.
Are on it, and it's not your journal, like you have a paper
right
in the journal, but all of a sudden having a book that is kind of yours, it's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
And that's too, you know, I remember when I learned to program when I was maybe 12, I couldn't program very well, but I had this Texas Instrument that time it was very new, but a computer. And I could run a program, and I created it.
Sure.
It was this tremendous sense, or, you know, making ashtrays from, you know, clay or whatever, cups from something. As society is becoming more advanced, we're less able to truly create things that are ours. Right? We can take IKEA furniture and assemble it. But it's much harder to create something complete. Even if you're a programmer, it's very hard these days to make the whole program yourself. Like, you need lots of help, right, from lots of people with different skills and so on. And I think we've lost something. Like, if you could have something and says, I did everything about this, here's a thing that I created, my pride is connected to it.
Yeah.
I think we have fewer and fewer of those things that naturally allow us to associate pride with them. But nevertheless, we could get associated together with other people. There's all kinds of ways to do it. We just need to help people take more pride.
Yeah.
In what they're doing.
Another element that you mentioned that's key in motivation is a sense of meaning, that it fits into some larger framework of meaning that gives it value.
Yeah, and you know, meaning is really interesting, because often what gives something meaning is not what gives it joy. And you know, if you think about I start the book by describing a very badly injured kid that contacted me, but I don't want to tell this story here, but I'll tell you a different story. There was a guy who called me about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago. He called me up and he told me that he got paralyzed. He was a quadriplegic. And he said that, and he wanted to talk about how to run his life. And this was on the year anniversary of his injury. And at that point, he kind of realized that he was not going to get better. And we talked about all kinds of things. And then he asked me about, what do I think about committing suicide? And I said, you know, I'm not against it, but, you know, let's think about what else you could do, and let's experiment and try to figure out what are some other options. So we came up with two other options of things that he could try. He felt that all the books that says, oh, I got injured and it was the best thing that happened to me in my life and so on, were bullshit. And one of the things we said was that he will write a book how this is bullshit.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, he had an uncle who was working on some piece of software company, and he thought he could help him with some things in programming, and we agreed he would do that. And we kept on talking about once a week, and he didn't really try any of those things. We kept on talking about them, but he never really tried. And 4 months later, he committed suicide. Now, this whole process, right, was difficult and painful and time-consuming. Of course, much more difficult and time-consuming for him than for me. But, you know, here I was. Somebody is asking me for, you know, time every week to talk to them. And it's not pleasurable. In the basic sense that there was not a single moment in this discussion with him that I burst out laughing, or that, you know, I said, oh, this is better than, watching Seinfeld or whatever it is, right? It was not pleasurable in the momentary sense of saying I am deriving some joy from this, but nevertheless, it was very meaningful. It was very meaningful, even though it was a failure, right? Maybe I made his life for those last 5 months a bit more interesting. Maybe I helped him commit suicide. I'm not sure, but it was certainly, as we were talking about all of those things, and I was helping him try to think about what he wants to do and not want to do and how to try and so on. Maybe I'm delusional, but...
Well, it was a meaningful experience for him, and you were very engaged, right? The dimension of meaning made it very engaging for you.
Yeah, and he wanted to talk to me every week, and I was happy to talk to him when he wanted to talk. So this is the idea that meaning is not the same as happiness. Meaning is actually very different. Meaning is about, and there's lots of ways to think about meaning, but part of it is feeling that there's a purpose and that your efforts count and that you might help somebody else in some way. But it's often not about a simple feeling of joy or happiness. And, we have the freedom to pursue happiness.
Yeah.
Right. We have the right to pursue happiness, but I'm not sure that's really what we want to pursue.
Yeah. And there's this movement, as I'm sure you know, positive psychology. And I think a lot of the research that's come out of that, they've come to a similar place that it's not necessarily about happiness per se, these dimensions such as meaning. You talked about, you said your book ends with death, and in the sense of legacy, of having, that's another dimension of meaning, I guess, is to feel like, okay, my work will outlive me. I'll leave a legacy. And you had some very quirky examples.
Yeah, one of my favorite one is there's a guy that used to fight all of his life with his wife about his smoking cigars. And his wife just made his life miserable. So in his will, he left her money on the condition that once a year on the anniversary of his death, she will smoke a cigar. And only then. But, you think about, actually, I've talked to lots of people about this. The number of people who try to settle scores after they die, so interesting, right? They want to take revenge of people that hurt them. They want to make happy the people that were nice to them. After they die, why not do it before, right? What's the point? And these are not people who necessarily believe in the afterlife or that they will reincarnate in the same place. But so that this case about death and meaning at death, I think, is very informative because it tells us something about, you have no reputation, you no longer live, but nevertheless, you care about what will happen to your legacy and so on.
Yeah.
We did start a project recently on what people want to happen to all of their digital artifacts. What do you want to happen to your Facebook page and your Twitter page and all the pictures and all of the stuff that you've left as digital footprints on the world after you die? Very, very few people want for all of those to just disappear.
I'm wrestling with that with this podcast, It's like I want this to somehow live on and all this material, and who's going to make sure that happens? And I've even tried to develop a little bit of a will to talk to somebody who can come and say, well, Dr. Dave isn't here today, and here's why he's moved on. And I haven't encountered any other podcasters that are talking about this.
Yeah, but they're also, most podcasters are probably a couple of years younger.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, it is interesting to think about legacy because it is usually when we say, oh, you're investing in your reputation and so on, you can say, oh, you get some benefit from this, right? But when you die, you don't get any benefits. No. It's just kind of pure interest in other people's memories and impressions and so on. So very interesting. One last thing I have to run, but I'll tell you, I was in a slum in South Africa, in Soweto, and I saw a father buying funeral insurance. So funerals in South Africa are very expensive. People can spend maybe 2 years of income on funeral. And this father bought funeral insurance and got the little certificate, and he bought it only for a month. He didn't have money for more. And he gave the certificate in a very ceremonious way to his son. And when he did that, I thought, you know, usually when a breadwinner in the family, usually they buy stuff for the family. The family appreciates them for buying, you know, food and water and fruit and whatever it is. And when the breadwinner buys savings, you know, saves the money or buy insurance, nobody knows about it. It's a hidden thing. And here was the case where he took something invisible, spending money on insurance, and making it visible and making some kind of recognition about it, and basically saying, this is my job of taking care of the family. Mm-hmm. And my job of taking care of the family is not just taking care of food and water on the table. It's also making sure that if something wrong happens, here I am to take care of it. And basically, you know, sacrificing now for what will happen after he died. So, yeah, I think it's a little depressing to think a lot about death, but lots of interesting lessons there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, your research is so fascinating, and you're a fascinating presenter. So hopefully this won't be the last time we talk. Keep letting me know as your accomplishments continue to stack up.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to the next time.
Okay. Dr. Dan Ariely, I want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure.
This interview was both shorter and longer than expected. Shorter because I screwed up the technology by going to the wrong video chat room and kept Dan waiting for about 5 or 6 minutes thinking he was late until I discovered it was my error. In addition, I knew from the past that he prefers to limit interviews to under 30 minutes, so I expected that he would bail sooner than he did. So in that sense, it was longer than it might have been. I think he got sufficiently engaged in our conversation that he stayed as long as he could before needing to move on to another commitment. This was all gravy as far as I'm concerned, because Dan Ariely is a major figure in the field, and I'm grateful for whatever time I can get from him. For example, consider the fact that if you go onto TED.com, you'll find that he's been a presenter there 3 times. I doubt that many others have had that distinction. In fact, his book is published under a TED.com imprint. I didn't even know they had moved into publishing. I had thought my question about what motivated him to write this book would move us into that territory, but it was clear he preferred to move quickly into more substantive discussion of the book itself. One of the interesting things to me is the way that, starting from a very different place as an experimental social psychologist, so many of the findings of his research on human motivation support the findings and assumptions of both humanistic and positive psychology. Meaning, legacy, creative expression, social connection, recognition, contributing to something significant, and so on, are key human motivations, often trumping money. I think Dan Ariely is good at practicing what he preaches. Instead of me having to reach out to him for this interview, he actually contacted me, letting me know that he had this new book out and that he'd love the opportunity to speak about it with my audience. So, of course, I felt very honored that 6 years later, a figure of his stature in the field would reach out to me. Similarly, his subsequent emails conveyed a down-to-earth humility and respect that made me feel honored and willing to help in any way. In other words, he motivated me in the best possible way. On the heels of our interview, I received an email announcement of an app that he's created. Let me share his email with you here. Dear David, questions of fairness come up in our lives on a daily basis. Each of us has a unique view of what is and isn't fair. The current climate in the United States, particularly in this heated election, makes for endless curiosity, controversy, and dialogue. Our new app, Fair Game? Asks questions about aspects of life in the United States. Users answer questions as they learn about themselves and society. The goal of the app is to get answers to intriguing questions about equality and inequality and to start thinking critically about these issues. If you're interested in downloading the app Fair Game, here are the links. And then he gives a link in iTunes and a link to Google Play. So I'm sure you can find these on your own. Also, the results are in, he says. There are 13 questions we've asked users regarding the way equality is now and the way they feel it should be, and the findings are fascinating. So far, the data show a consistent knowledge gap. For example, on average, people think CEOs earn as much as 151 combined workers' salaries, when in reality, CEOs earn as much as 303 combined workers' salaries. Most results can be found here. And the here is actually a link to his blog at danariely.com. And you'll find it in the resources area, so you'll find his blog. He goes on to say, we'll update new results every few days. You can view them on my website's blog, and again, that's danariely.com. Ariely is spelled A-R-I-E-L-Y. He concludes saying, if you'd like to schedule an interview or speak further about Fair Game, I would love to hear back from you. Fairly and equally yours, Dan. Well, I haven't had a chance to download the app yet, but my initial impression is that he's come up with a very creative and pro-social way to get us all involved in a research project and do something good in the process. If you're interested in learning more about behavioral economics, you might be interested in my earlier interview from 6 years ago, Shrink Wrap Radio number 243, Exploring Behavioral Economics with Dan Ariely. If you would like to order his book, Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations, you are encouraged to do so by using our Amazon affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lara Just. I'm a qualified therapist in London, and I'm also just about to embark on a very exciting postgraduate research about therapists' use of client-generated metaphors. Next to this, I also work as a mind-body practitioner, coach, nutritionist, and change manager at a big NHS London hospital. I decided to support the work of Dr. Dave because his podcast has been a staple nourishment, so to speak, for me throughout the past year or more. It's been so relevant for me and my training and personal development. I just love listening to one of his latest podcasts, especially while on a run along the river. I really enjoy Dr. Dave's way of engaging so personably with his interviewees, some of the most exquisite speakers in the field from around the world. The diversity and variety of topics and speakers really convey Dr. Dave's efforts to give listeners the breadth as well as some depth of knowledge. I also really like that Dr. Dave appears to be so open-minded, bringing in some newer thought models in the holistic and mind-body-spirit fields. For me, the podcast series has been fantastic. And if you think so too, please support Dr. Dave so he can continue with his amazing job. So get onto your smartphones or computer now, go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and press on the green donate button. Really, it only takes a couple of minutes. Thank you, Dr. Dave. Please keep your podcast going with many more interesting topics and for many more years to come. Lots of love from London.
Wow, Laura in London. Thanks for that incredible endorsement. I like getting lots of love from London and other places as well. If that doesn't get some of the fence-sitters out there moving, I don't know what will. So if you're not already a financial supporter, I hope you'll join Laura as a donor. Now, as you heard at the beginning of the show, we do have a relatively new sponsor for this month, and I hope you'll go to their website so that they'll see Shrink Wrap Radio as maybe a good place to advertise in future months. And as we've mentioned before, Swellbee.com is a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers. So what does that mean, health and wellness providers? Maybe you know that Psychology Today has a site where therapists can go, and it's a directory. They can describe the kinds of conditions that they treat, the kinds of people they want to see, what their skill background is, and so on. Well, this is something along those lines, but much broader. For example, under types of providers that they're open to are acupuncturist, art therapist, audiologist, chiropractor, doula, lactation consultant, life coach, massage therapist, mental health therapist, midwife, nutritionist, dietitian, occupational therapist, physical therapist, respiratory therapist, speech therapist, and who knows, I wouldn't be surprised if there are some others that maybe aren't in that list, but that would still qualify. So this really is creating a new marketplace for a wide variety of people helpers, and it's really meant to give you a resource if you're in that category needing to advertise your services. So Swellbee's goal is simple. It's to help providers save time, to increase revenue, to improve the overall patient experience, and patients or clients can quickly find your profile online after you join Swellbee's marketplace of verified health and wellness professions. As we've mentioned, the site is highly secure and it's HIPAA compliant. So for a limited time, they're offering this service for free. So go ahead and get yourself listed for free by heading to their website and signing up at www.swellbee.com. And once again, Swellbee is S-W-E-L-L-B-Y. Once again, if you're a user of our Shrink Wrap Radio app, you may have noticed that I've resumed putting up short video previews a day or so before the interview. So I hope you're enjoying and appreciating that extra effort on my part. But there's another great thing I just recently discovered is that the app actually gives you access to the most recent 300 episodes. Imagine that, walking around with 300 Shrink Wrap Radio interviews in your pocket or purse. That's practically a whole graduate psychology education. So if you don't have our app, it is available for all smartphones. So even, I imagine the new Google phone, Pixel phone. So go to the apps tab at Shrink Wrap Radio for full information. And remember, you can find both the video preview and the full video of the interview on my YouTube channel. If you're not getting it on our app, you can find it all at youtube.com/shrinkwrapradio. I had lunch today with my friend Ofer Zur of the Zur Institute, through whom we're able to offer you a world of CE courses using the discount code of Dr. Dave 88. That's D-R-D-A-V-E 88. And he was complaining that the Shrink Wrap Radio website looks so old. According to him, it's at least two or three generations behind. He and his staff think I'd have more listeners if I had a more contemporary-looking website. I'm not sure if that's true or not. But the site doesn't really bring in enough money to justify spending the thousands of dollars that a new website would probably cost. So let me just put it out there that if you're a person with mad site-building skills using WordPress, because it's currently a WordPress site, and you'd be willing to do it as a volunteer or for a steep discount, please let me know. Just write me shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, this is John Markoff, New York Times science writer and author of the 2015 book, Machines of Loving Grace, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, John Markoff, who was my guest on episode number 475, The Social Psychological Impact of Artificial Intelligence and Robotics. And you know, those are topics that really fascinate me. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Dan, who writes, Dr. Dave, I listened to the interview with Michael Mervosh today while moving my... I listened to the interview with Michael Mervosh today while mowing my lawn, and it was so great. You seemed to really be enjoying each other, and it was a lovely and informative interview. This past summer was my first experience with Michael's work, and it was so deep and meaningful that I wanted to learn more about him. Thank you for helping me learn more about his work and to reflect back on my experience a bit. I was not expecting to hear my name on the podcast, so that was a special surprise. My 15 seconds of fame, perhaps. All the best. And that's from Dan Gross. Well, Dan, I really want to thank you for having suggested Michael Mervosh as a good person to interview. I was very excited by my engagement with him. It made a big impact on me. And now you get another 15 seconds of fame, having your email read here on the line and being the recipient of my gratitude. And also, just to let everybody know that you're recommendations are heard, as Dan's was, and that I often act on them. It's greatly expanded the range of my knowledge of who's out there and who needs to be interviewed. Not able to get to everybody who gets recommended to me, but certainly it's been a great resource and way to find important people to speak with. This next one comes from Arash, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I recently found Shrink Wrap Radio. It's such a great resource, and I can't thank you enough for the work you do to provide so many people with these interviews. I paid for the app on iTunes and plan on starting a small recurring contribution soon. I'm emailing in particular because I was trying to listen to some of your Wise Counsel podcast episodes today. However, I cannot stream or download them from iTunes, the native podcast app for iOS, or third-party apps. It says the episodes are temporarily unavailable. Would you know when they might become available again? Thanks again, Arash. Well, Arash, I really wish that they were available. I was hired by a company called mentalhelp.net. to conduct those interviews, and as a result, they own them. The company has stopped providing those interviews as they kind of changed direction. And the person who's in charge of, you know, who owns those, I've tried to do some negotiating with him, and I have not been successful. I'm starting to think maybe I'll release his name and contact information here. And listeners who really want to have that material be available can perhaps persuade him to make them available somehow. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't have to be in my, you know, in the Shrink Wrap Radio collection. I don't have to make any money off of it, but I would just like to have it be available to people. So I appreciate your asking. And I would really like to see that move forward. This next one comes from Chinga. And Chinga writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I came upon your podcast just this last week. I'm so thankful for the amount of intriguing information on it. I'm researching psychology-related outlooks for my personal statement for an application to study psychology next year as a 43-year-old mature student at Surrey University here in England. The variety of interviewees you've had on the show do a wonderful job of showcasing the numerous perspectives / pathways people have been inspired toward after studying psychology. As a soon-to-be undergraduate, I'm so encouraged by the boundary-pushing research concluded in areas that classically would have been shunned. Dead and buried is the archaic era of, if you can't measure it, it probably doesn't exist. I love the idea of learning the scientific basis of the discipline and I know I would benefit hugely from doing this as a springboard for being of service in the world. I also have the intellectual archetype, and that part of me will be totally fulfilled. Till now, I hadn't had the opportunity to study at this level, but have longed to do so all my adult life. Prior to deciding to study psychology, I've witnessed many alternative healing practices that bring troubled lives back to balance. I've also seen elderly people that have never done therapy in their life affirm that they have led a good life. So it's actually my view that therapy is one of numerous other ways to deal with the problems we face in life. May I ask, what words of wisdom would you give to someone like me wanting to study psychology? If you were me today, aware of all you've experienced and learned in your educational life and career to date, would you still opt to study psychology? I appreciate your work. Kind regards, and that's from Chinga in England. And I did write back to Chinga, and I said that I've had quite a bit of experience with older students coming back to school when I was a professor, and usually they were worried that they would not be able to hold up in the competition with younger students, that the younger students would be faster and sharper and so on. And in my experience, that was not true, because the older students had some advantages of their own, which were a heightened sense of motivation and maturity, such that they could really focus on the material rather than, you know, being thinking about parties and dates and, you know, their next rendezvous and all of that. So I really did encourage her. And I also was able to determine that making an income wasn't, from her study of psychology, wasn't a major factor. And so, you know, if that had been a major factor, I might have had second thoughts about urging her to go ahead at a late age, because she would need to go on to get at least a master's degree, if not a doctorate degree. And so that would, you know, take up a lot of time of being a potential earner. But that was not a big factor for her. And so I would say, if I were starting over again and that were not a factor for me, sure, I would study psychology again. I would do it all over again. Finally, here's one last one from longtime listener and friend in Stockholm, Sweden, Oscar, who writes commenting on my recent interview with Alexandra Katahakis on sex and love addiction in episode number 527. And Oscar writes, "What a pearl this interview was. Exactly the kind that gets me going, with intense focus on the subject and less emphasis on the interviewee's background. More density, less chit-chat. Like a lecture in dialogue form, if that makes sense. Awesome." Well, Oscar, I really like that one as well. So I agree. And, you know, the chit-chat is a way of establishing rapport, but I've also sometimes gotten some negative feedback about it. So there's definitely an audience out there that wants me to dive right in to the meaty content. So I think with that, we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail using our aforementioned app or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Dan Ariely, for his insights on the hidden logic behind our motivations. And my next interview will be with return guest Dr. John C. Robinson on his latest book, The Divine Human, The Final Transformation of Sacred Aging. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.